Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. There was a line about Donald Trump that got repeated many times during the campaign, especially by his surrogates in the media. Liberals take Trump literally but not seriously. Trump supporters take him seriously but not literally. Well, he proved his supporters right yesterday on the don't take him literally part in his interview with a group of New York Times reporters and columnists. Appoint a special prosecutor to reinvestigate Hillary Clinton? Well, as of yesterday, that's no longer a plan. He said he doesn't want to hurt the Clintons. Lock her up is over. Waterboarding, and worse than waterboarding, as he put it during the campaign, to get information from terrorism suspects. Now Trump says his leading candidate for defense secretary, General James Mattis, says it doesn't work, and now Trump believes him. The New York Times itself, no longer despicable. Now it's a world jewel. On President Obama, who he called the founder of ISIS, I really liked him a lot, and I'm a little surprised that I am telling you that I really liked him a lot, Trump said. Global warming is a hoax? I guess that turned out to be the hoax. Now he says there is some connectivity, his word, with human emissions, and he may not pull us out of the 200-nation Paris Climate Accord after all. He's looking at it closely and has an open mind. And he clearly denounced the white nationalist movement that calls itself the alt-right. He has mostly tried to avoid the topic before. So are you disillusioned if you voted for Trump because of the things he's been taking back? Or did you always take him seriously, but not literally, and he is still the Trump you voted for in ways that matter more? And for everybody else, are you relieved to any degree if the Trump campaign and his appointments of Bannon, Flynn, and Sessions made you afraid for yourself or the country now that you're hearing another side of him? Call in and give us your reactions at 212-433-WNYC. With the Times interview getting so much detailed coverage in the Times and elsewhere, 212-433-9692. My first guest today is Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamelle Bouie, who, among other things, has argued against Democrats going right on to policymaking with Trump so as not to normalize the hate in Trump's campaign as part of a package you can sort of shrug off and do business with. Hi, Jamelle. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So we'll get to how reassured you were, if at all, by yesterday's interview. But I want to set up for our listeners what you were objecting to. You criticized Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren by name for quickly preparing to do business with Trump on populist agenda items. Here's a version of that. This is Bernie Sanders on this program a week ago today saying he's not just willing, he's going to push Trump to do business.
He talked about being a quote-unquote champion of the working class when he speaks about the needs of working families, when he speaks about the needs of high unemployment rates in minority communities, that he actually fulfills what he said.
Bernie Sanders here last week. Jamelle Bouie, Slate's chief political correspondent, here now. Why did you write an article in response to statements like that?
So I think the thing about statements like that from Sanders, like Warren, is, and it's important, I think, to kind of look at the full scope of their statements. So typically, when making this argument about working together with Trump, they begin by saying, you know, Trump's campaign was a populist campaign. He was speaking to the concerns of the working class, and that's why he won. And so my first problem with that is that's just not an accurate characterization of the campaign Donald Trump ran. Donald Trump ran first and foremost as a candidate against sort of the browning of America. And so he opens his campaign not with a discussion of trade deals, but going after Mexican immigrants and going after the Chinese and sort of casting America's economic problems as primarily a function of an almost invasion by foreign forces, whether domestic or international. And he hits his highs throughout the campaign going against Muslim Americans, going against Hispanics again, so on and so forth. And so that's sort of, you know, after observing the campaign for 18 months, that seems to me to be the core character of the campaign. And the insofar that it was a campaign aimed at working Americans, it was aimed very specifically at white working Americans. And I think that is the character of the campaign, that thus far has been the character of many of Trump's appointments, or at least a handful of very prominent appointments.
So
if that's true.
Go ahead. Sorry.
If that's the case, then to say, you know, I'm willing to work with Trump on these populist agenda items, it ends up ignoring the extent to which doing so and, you know, maybe delivering Trump a political victory, whether that's a political victory around raising the minimum wage or delivering an infrastructure bill, directly bolsters a style of campaigning and a style of politics that is sort of narrow casted at white workers, that excludes workers of color. And if that's the case, and it's I find it difficult to call that any kind of like working class politics. It's very specifically a politics for white workers.
Take me further into that, though, because you wrote that supporting a Trump-branded infrastructure initiative as a distinct piece of policy, for example, where two sides can find common ground, only bolsters a white national politics if you oppose the rest of Trump's agenda, you wrote. So explain how that does that if they say make a deal on infrastructure but filibuster a Muslim registry if he were to propose one.
Because, again, part of Trump's appeal, part of Trump's argument for his presidency was that he would hold the line against immigrants, against Muslims, against black protesters. That was part of his populist appeal. And so delivering substantive victories to Donald Trump, even if they have nothing to do nominally to do with race, if they're just a plain infrastructure bill or just a minimum wage increase, though I think it's important to say that there are plenty of ways to craft an infrastructure bill such that you're rewarding white workers more than you're rewarding workers of color. But that reifies a style of politics. What that says is what that says to the workers to which Trump appealed is that you can vote on your hate or you can vote on your disdain. You can ignore those things and still be rewarded substantively for your vote. And there's no amount of decrying any explicit prejudice from a Trump administration that changes the fact that those were his style of politics, and delivering legislative victories to him or helping him achieve legislative victories bolster that style of politics in the same way that Republicans during the Obama administration were actually quite right in arguing in terms of the political impact that working to help pass major legislative packages with Obama would end up bolstering Obama's political star, irrespective of their reasons for doing so and irrespective of their opposition to other elements mm-hmm. of the Obama agenda.
Let me play another clip. It's sort of another version of the Bernie Sanders clip, but it's longer and it's different in a way. Tell me if you think it's different in a meaningful way. This is my exchange with New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in her interview here on Monday. And she was talking about working with Trump on some things similar to Sanders and Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren. And I asked her directly about this risk of normalizing Trump's bigotry by doing business with him on anything. And Senator Gillibrand said this, picking up on the word normalizing. And this is a longer clip. This is about a minute and a half. But you'll hear how she picks up on the word normalizing. Then goes into some detail about how she would fight his various kinds of bigotry, but still singles out one issue that she's interested in, paid leave.
Well, I agree that we cannot normalize him and where he has stated his goals. I mean, he is so far outside the mainstream on so many issues. And so I think the instincts of many of folks I've talked to over the last week and a half, we have to be vigilant. And his racism, his anti-Semitism, his sexism, the things that he exudes in various statements, that cannot be normalized. And we have to fight like hell on those issues specifically. Now, if he does want to work on a paid leave plan and lets me write the bill, that's a very different scenario. But we cannot give an inch on these basic civil rights and human rights. We cannot. And when he says things that are racist, sexist, or homophobic, we have to bring down an enormous hammer because it's not acceptable. And it's not acceptable for the president-elect and our future president to talk that way or to have policies that reflect that kind of worldview. do. And that's why every time he nominates someone who we are concerned about, because they either have racist statements in their past or anti-Semitic statements in their past, it creates alarm bells for all of us, because we have no place to trust him that he's going to work in a reasonable way. And so that's why fundamentally I'm skeptical. I'm not optimistic that this will work out for any of us. And I think it's going to be a very long haul of fighting and protesting and speaking out and demanding our rights and not creating an environment where we let things slide.
Did you say on paid paternal leave or parental leave, if he lets you write the bill?
Yeah, my bill's great. If he wants to support it, it's a good thing. It would make a huge difference for America.
So that was Senator Gillibrand here on Monday. And, you know, that was different from when Sanders was here last week, because he didn't want to linger on the normalization question. He just wants to say, yes, of course, we're not going to normalize anything that has to do with racism or bigotry, but I want an infrastructure bill. I'm going to push him to an infrastructure bill. I'm going to push him to be hard on Wall Street, because he talked hard on Wall Street in the campaign. You heard the difference in emphasis there. Is that any better or different than what Sanders and Warren have been saying to your ear?
I think that's a little better, in part because Senator Gillibrand began to focus on appointments and nominations in the executive branch and the way in which that kind of influences the picture. Sort of, I think the shortcoming of the rhetoric from Sanders and rhetoric is not recognizing that passing an infrastructure bill, for example, doesn't keep Jeff Sessions-led DOJ from cracking down on African-American protesters, right? That, and in fact, delivering a political benefit may actually provide some sort of political cover to the latter. And Gillibrand seems to be inching closer to recognizing this fact, right? That if Trump is nominating and appointing people like Sessions or Stephen Bannon, that really does throw a huge doubt on any ability to work with him on anything else. But I would even say, you know, let's say that in some crazy world, Donald Trump lets Senator Gillibrand write a paid leave bill. It remains the fact that you'll have to balance that with a Trump, equal employment opportunity commission that basically ignores discrimination against people of color, against women, right?
And so, assuming that's true, are you suggesting that the Democrats in Congress should just do no business with Trump whatsoever?
I'm suggesting that there needs to be one sort of baseline condition, and that is if the Trump administration does anything within the executive branch, within the kinds of people it nominates to federal agencies or the federal bench, if it does anything to signal any kind of aggressiveness, malignancy, anything like that towards people of color, whether Muslim Americans, African Americans, Hispanic immigrants, if it does anything like that, then that is the automatic deal breaker for the Democratic Party. That an infrastructure bill could be great, but if Donald Trump is going to insist on having Jeff Sessions at the DOJ, then no deal. I think that's the only way to avoid a situation where you are effectively giving cover to Trump on the elements of his rhetoric that drove the crowds, that got him the attention.
Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate with us. You quoted positively in your article Senator Harry Reid, who said, "We as a nation must find a way to move forward without consigning those who Trump has threatened to the shadows. Their fear is entirely rational because Donald Trump has talked openly about doing terrible things to them. If this is going to be a time of healing, we must first put the responsibility for healing where it belongs, at the feet of Donald Trump, a sexual predator who lost the popular vote and fueled his campaign with bigotry and hate. Winning the Electoral College does not absolve Trump of the grave sins he committed against millions of Americans. Donald Trump may not possess the capacity to assuage those fears, but he owes it to the nation to try." Harry Reid from the other day, which you quoted in one of your Slate pieces. So did Trump begin to try yesterday in his New York Times interview, in your opinion, and maybe in addition to his previous walking back of a Muslim ban and mass deportation of law-abiding people?
You know, given the extent to which it's clear that Trump is willing to change positions on a dime, the common criticism is that he tends to listen to whomever he last spoke to, and then he also tends to be very obsequious and seeking of approval in interviews. I don't necessarily think that we can count on what he said over the past few days to represent any meaningful change from the rhetoric he deployed during the campaign. And I say that specifically because, again, one of his top advisors now is Stephen Bannon, who advised him during the campaign, who has been very vocal about his affinity for a kind of white nationalist politics, white nationalism, simply meaning the idea that the United States is primarily a country for white Americans and that it should be understood and shaped in along those lines. It is belied. Trump's sort of newfound rhetoric is belied again by his choice of Jeff Sessions, who has been a devoted opponent of civil rights legislation for his entire time in Congress. And so looking at these choices, his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who has called Islam a cancer, right? Looking at these choices, they are far at odds with any kind of conciliatory rhetoric. And so to think that the rhetoric is what matters and not the people he's putting in positions to influence and shape policy seems to me to be a mistake.
The news this morning is that he'll appoint South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley as UN ambassador and is leaning toward Mitt Romney as Secretary of State after Bannon, Sessions, and Flynn and what they represent. How do you see the emerging package if this is in fact what happens with these two?
I mean, I maybe I'm being a little cynical, but I see that emerging package as attempting to preempt any criticism of Bannon, Sessions, and Flynn. And Chris Kobach, who is the Kansas Secretary of State, who's an advisor to Donald Trump, who, you know, thanks to a mistake he made carrying documents out in the open, a photographer captured a shot of the documents. We could see that Kobach had drawn up plans for some sort of registry based off of religion for people coming into the country. And so, you know, looking at all of that, I'm actually kind of stunned by the amount of credulousness I see with regards to the talk around Romney and around Haley as some sort of moderating influence. I think people are very much underestimating the degree to which it is very possible for Trump administration to focus on the things he focused on in his rhetoric, while at the same time offering a patina of moderation through other means.
Let's hear what some callers have to say. First, we'll hear from people who didn't vote for Trump. And then in a few minutes, we'll open up the phones for people who did vote for Trump to see if you're kind of shaking your head and going, what? What's he doing? Why is he changing all these positions? But first, for people who've been freaked out by the election of Donald Trump, on behalf of yourself or on behalf of others, Judy and Chelsea are on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I have a three-word comment, or perhaps it's two words, with one being a hyphen, and that is three-card Monty. Perhaps we didn't do ourselves any favors in New York City when we essentially banned that game, because all you have to do is take a look at what happens with that street game. You will never win. You will never find the pee or whatever is being hidden under the cards or the shells, and you just work on that assumption that you are always going to lose. So whether it's Newt Romney or it's Sessions, just just look at the essential goals, stated and otherwise, of this administration, the upcoming administration.
But what are the essential goals? If he's suddenly going back on saying he'll pull us out of the climate accord, if he's suddenly going back on saying he'll reinstate waterboarding, if he's suddenly going back on saying he's going to be the kind of banana republic president who's going to prosecute his political opponents like Hillary Clinton, then What is the center?
Let's start with his approach to taxes, because I think there are two things alongside each other. There's the bigotry, and then there's also the contempt for having a country that can actually function. We need money to function. So his tax cuts are going to the most wealthy.
Right. So you want to go to the tax cuts. And Judy, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Another one, Marvin in Brooklyn. Marvin, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Okay. If we had Brian there as the voice of talk radio, we wouldn't have Trump as president. I think that the gentleman
one voice of talk radio. There can be many. Go ahead.
The gentleman from Slate is spot on in terms of his analysis of Trump and how dangerous he will continue to be, but he's wrong about the politics of combating him. The election was lost because the issue was economics, which it always is, and the Democrats have to show that they're going to be supporting working people. Unfortunately, what we saw, and by supporting working people, to also be defending all minority groups and disadvantaged people.
So I don't want to go into how the election was lost. Are you assuaged at all? Are you relieved at all by hearing all these reversals from Trump in the last few days?
No.
Why?
Because Trump is Trump. The only thing that can relieve us is if the Democrats come up with a winning strategy to combat Trump and also to regain power on a local level and on a national level. What your guest is proposing won't end up rebuilding the needed majority to gain political power. And that's the crux of it, that you need to have a strategy, a political strategy, not just an analysis of Trump's weaknesses.
Marvin, thank you very much.
Brian,
please.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yeah.
Just to reply to Marvin, and that is to say that one thing I've noticed in this conversation, both here and sort of the broader conversation, is people are making this division between working people and minorities, not recognizing that the category of working people includes minorities, and that disproportionately people of color and Black Americans and Hispanic Americans in particular would fall under what you would call the working class, that they work, they use their labor to get wages to live. So looking at the Trump administration and any possible cooperation with the Trump administration, you can't simply say we're going to work with the Trump administration to help working people, knowing that the Trump administration is also going to make moves against voting rights, is also unlikely to even investigate abusive police departments, may even defend them, so on and so forth. Because those are working issues too. Working class Black people need protection from unfair police violence as much as they need higher wages. And so if you are giving cover to an administration to sort of act badly on the latter in order to get something on the former, like infrastructure, then you're not helping working people as a category. You are helping a particular subset of working people. And maybe that's what you want to do. Maybe you are more concerned with winning over white workers as opposed to workers of color. But then say that. But let's not
mm-hmm. Yeah,
sort of pretend there's this division here.
And you also have written since the election about Trump voters. The headline is, there's really no such thing as a good Trump voter. Do you go that far in the piece?
I don't go that far in the piece. That's a case of a headline very much designed to get people to read. Probably makes them very angry as well. But what I argue in the piece very specifically is that I say it does not in fact matter the intentions of a given voter, even Trump voter, knowing what he campaigned on and knowing what he promised to do. And so if Trump, for example, does move forward with registering Muslim Americans with the government, you cannot say if you voted for Trump that I did not vote for that, because Trump said he would do that. And that's one of the things he campaigned on. And so your attempt to declare yourself innocent of that is just unpersuasive. And people should take responsibility for the kinds of forces they empower. And in this case, 61 million people empowered a candidate who campaigned openly on using the state to push back against sort of growing diversity in America. And so if you don't like that agenda, then I'm sorry, but that's what you voted for as much as you voted for maybe a jobs bill.
David Brooks wrote sort of the opposite column in the New York Times the other day with the headline, "Fellow Trump Critics, Maybe Try a Little Listening." And he writes, "I've been thinking a lot about the best imaginable Trump voter. This is the Trump supporter who wasn't motivated by racism or bigotry. This is the one who cringed every time Donald Trump did something cruel, vulgar, or misogynistic. But this voter needed somebody to change the systems that are failing her. She needed somebody to change the public school system that serves the suburban children, blah, 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 blah." And then later he writes, "It's not my cup of tea, but I can see why some good people might be willing to tolerate Trump and Bannon's personalities in order to pursue it," meaning these other policy agendas. "Thinking about this best voter has helped me take an emotional pause. Many of my fellow Trump critics are expressing outrage, depression, bewilderment, or disgust. They're marching or writing essays. Should we normalize Trump or fight the normalizers? It all seems so useless during this transition moment. It's all a series of narcissistic displays and discussions about our own emotional states." Any reaction to that?
I do have a reaction to that, and that is that at the risk of sounding a little melodramatic, if a good person votes for someone who wants to put their boot on my neck because they want to shake up the system, it doesn't change the fact that that person they elected has their boot on my neck. That there's this attempt to sort of use the inner states of Trump voters, who again, I really have to emphasize this, who voted for a campaign that ran specifically on, restricting immigration and attacking Hispanic immigrants, on cracking down on black protesters, on registering and stigmatizing Muslims. That was the explicit rhetoric of the campaign. And so to say that, I can imagine this this best possible Trump voter who is a good person, just wanted to shake up the system, And that then somehow means that they are no longer responsible. They are no longer – they bear no obligation. They bear no culpability for whatever actions the Trump administration takes against minorities is ludicrous. I mean it's not logic that we hold in any other arena. If you simply drive someone to go rob a bank you didn't touch a weapon – you didn't do anything else with the planning. You merely drove them to the location. And maybe you vaguely heard they were going to go rob the bank and you just kind of ignored it. And they were like, can we get a ride? You are still responsible. You still have some culpability in what happened. And so this idea that Trump voters have no culpability, that the fact of their personal decency means that they cannot be held responsible is – I mean, it's frankly insanity. And the idea that somehow mitigates the fact that Trump has promised to put his boot on the necks of other Americans, that I just wanted things to get shooken up. And so I'm going to vote for a guy who says he'll do that. If I'm sounding a little emotional here, it's because I think it's an insane argument. I think it does not carry any water if you are someone who is a promised target of Donald Trump.
Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate. Jamel, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And now a call in for Trump supporters to tell us if you're unhappy about some of the reversals since the election, including the things he said to the Times yesterday. There was such a litany of them yesterday. If you voted for Donald Trump, how is he doing since the election, according to you? 212-433-WNYC. I mentioned the line about Trump that got repeated many times during the campaign by his surrogates in the media. Liberals take Trump literally but not seriously. Trump supporters take him seriously but not literally. And again, he sure proved his supporters right yesterday on the don't take him literally part. in his interview with a group of New York Times reporters and columnists. Appoint a special prosecutor to reinvestigate Hillary Clinton.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah, because you'd be in jail.
Well, as of yesterday, that's no longer a plan. He said he doesn't want to hurt the Clintons, lock her up, put her in jail, is over. Waterboarding, and worse than waterboarding, as he put it during the campaign, to get information from terrorism suspects?
I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
That was then. Now Trump says his leading candidate for defense secretary, General James Mattis, says it doesn't work, and now Trump believes him. The New York Times itself, no longer despicable. Now it's a, quote, world jewel, he told them yesterday. On President Obama, who he called the founder of ISIS, among many other things, I really liked him a lot, and I am a little bit surprised that I am telling you that I really liked him a lot, he said. Global warming is a hoax.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable.
I guess that turned out to be the hoax. Now he says there is some, quote, connectivity with human emissions, and he may not pull us out of the 200-nation Paris Climate Accord. After all, he's looking at it closely. The Muslim entry ban is apparently out, apparently being replaced by extreme vetting of people from selected hotspot countries. The mass deportation is off, except for convicted criminals, much like what Obama's been doing. Obamacare might be amended rather than repealed. The wall at the border might be partly a fence or even electronic sensors in some places. So the question is, are you disillusioned if you voted for Trump because of the things he took back yesterday and in the last 2 weeks? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or did you always take him seriously but not literally, and he's still the Trump you voted for in ways that you think will matter more? 212-433-9692. Virendra in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hello, Virendra.
Hi, sir. How are you? Good morning.
Thank you for calling. You voted for Trump?
Yes, I did.
And what did you want from him when you voted for him, and what do you think about all these changes now?
I'm a registered Democrat and voted for Democrats all throughout, but this time I voted for Trump, especially after the third debate I made up my mind. There are certain issues which Mr. Trump brought to the table, and hopefully he executes those things. The first one was NAFTA. I have been against the NAFTA agreement ever since I came to this country. The reason being, the GDP of a country cannot grow unless you have manufacturing done within the country.
And I will say, and we don't have time to re-argue NAFTA pro and con right now, but he does seem to be sticking to renegotiate NAFTA, and the Democrats seem ready to back him up on that. So that was one core thing for you. Do you have another?
Okay, yeah, I have another thing that another point that I voted for about the Syrian refugees. It means we can accept refugees as a nation. We have to accept the refugees, but at the same time, we don't have to do the blanket influx of refugees. There's enough space in Saudi Arabia and Egypt where all these refugees right. can be settled, where the world can give the money, but let the people settle yes. over there so that it's easier for them to go back to their country after.
And he is still on that one as far as anything that he said, as far as we could tell. No Syrian refugees. I think he's still at zero Syrian refugees. So all these other things, they're peripheral for you if he goes back on NAFTA and no refugees?
Third thing is on trade deficit with every single country that we do trade. We need to look into that very seriously.
Yes. Virendra, thank you very much. I appreciate it. All right. So his core issues have not been abandoned by Trump. And Johnny in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Johnny, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Big fan.
Thank you.
Listen to you for years.
Thank you. So you voted for Trump?
Yeah, I probably voted for Trump. I was a Obama Republican, but I came back to Republicans. I voted for Trump.
And you're in this whole other category that baffles a lot of Democrats. How could anybody who voted for Obama also vote for Trump?
My vote for Trump is a rejection of some of Obama's policies. I believe in American exceptionalism. I believe that the identity politics of the Democrats shifted a little bit too much to the left. I rejected the foreign policy decisions that they made. And I would, as a gentleman before, I'm not a big fan of NAFTA and international trade agreements that put us at a disadvantage.
And so this litany of things that you heard from the Times interview that Trump seems to be backpedaling on, how much do they bother you?
They don't bother me a lot. I know that during a campaign, people are bombastic. They say a lot of things. I know that they're not going to round up Muslims and deport them. I knew that geographically, building a concrete wall around the country, not really a realistic thing. You know, I held my nose, and I voted for Trump. It was just a question of the lesser of two evils.
And so if he goes for the trade deals in a different way and American exceptionalism, as you called it, greater strength, restoring greater strength, whatever that actually means, on, you know, internationally, that's the core of Trump for you, and you don't see him walking away from them.
Yeah, that's the important thing. I'm glad that he's not going after Hillary. I don't want to see him crucify her. My vote was, I voted my foreign policy in my pocketbook, and you know, you suck up the sweet and spit out the bitter. And that's the way I cast my vote.
Johnny, thank you very much. I appreciate it. William in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, William. You voted for Trump?
Yeah, I voted for Trump. Good morning. I'm proud that I voted for Trump, and I'm proud that he's going to make some changes and moderate some more, because actually that's what I was hoping for when I voted for him. So I'm encouraged by it.
You're encouraged by that. Thank you very much. Eric in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay.
I love the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, sir.
Sure.
Just wanted to say, let's just give Trump a chance. I'm happy some of these extreme positions are being walked back. I think we should all take a breath, you know, stop the hand-wringing, the teeth-gnashing. I think he's going to do fine. Let's give him a chance. Let's see what he has to do.
Thank you very much. Curtis in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Curtis.
Hey, Brian. I voted for Trump, and I feel like there are two things that we know about Donald Trump. Everybody was really worried when he was running, and I feel there were two major things we knew about him. Number one is that he is a New Yorker, and number two is that he's a businessman. And if you're a New Yorker and you're a businessman, you have to be pragmatic. And so I knew during the campaign that he was running a marketing campaign. He wasn't running an election campaign. And when you're trying to sell something, you say what you have to say to sell it. And after you sell it, when you get in the office and you get the paperwork signed, then you work out the details. But so I knew that he was going to walk back a bunch of the crazy stuff. I expect he won't leave the Paris Accord more than likely once he gets into a room with some climatologists. But he's going to do things that make the economy work better because he's a business person. And so he's going to change things that he needs to see change, but not in scale, not at mass. He just needed to sell his presidency. And so that's how I feel.
Any of those things that he's walking back on core enough to you that you're concerned with them?
No, I voted for him for two reasons. I voted for him because I voted for Obama, too. So I'm like the other caller. I voted for Obama twice. So, I mean, the thing that I'm most concerned about is the idea that is hatched in Davos, which is that nations are kind of an outdated, antiquated concept, and that they were going to basically open trade and have massive amounts of immigration, which in essence neutralizes borders and neutralizes nations. And he's like, no, America is a nation, and we have put a lot into this nation, and we want to keep America as America and not as some amalgam of regional or global trade agreements and global immigration agreements. And so he, as long as he sticks to those two things, and I hope he sticks to some environmental stuff because he has a lot of real estate in Manhattan, and Manhattan is an island, I'm good.
Curtis, thank you very much. And thanks to all of you who called on this segment. I guess not that this is a scientific poll in any way, But those who did not vote for Trump, who called in to a person, including the ones who were holding on the board, who he didn't have time to get to, were really not very relieved or assuaged, maybe a little, by these things that he walked back, because they don't trust him. They said he's got no policy anyway, and his core is this hateful core, and they don't trust him. And those of you who did vote for Trump, as you've heard from these last several callers, tend not to be bothered by the things that Trump has been walking back, because they were not really what he was about for them, locking up Hillary and pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord and waterboarding. So there you go. For what it's worth, a little smattering of Trump supporters, Trump detractors reacting to all those things from the New York Times interview yesterday and Jamelle Bouie's analysis from Slate. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay with us.